extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partner in soccer, Matt Doyle. Powder in Colorado, brown liquor specials for lunch for Mr. David Goss. That leaves the two of us, Doyle, and I have an issue. I have a conundrum. I have a problem. I have a shortcoming. My form is just not where it was in person, in the studio. I'm struggling, and I don't know what to do about it.
No, you're not hitting it. You gotta rediscover whatever it was you were doing before those pandemic shows to get into the groove and get your state of mind right for extra time.
I'm in a basement right now, same as in Kansas City.
Peloton is behind you.
There's windows in this basement, which I didn't have in the other one. It was more of a prison setting. So maybe that's my issue. Now, the other explanation here is that I had a terrible case of the flu between the final recording of 2023 and the first recording of 2024. There's a chance my vocal cords were damaged and have not yet recovered. May not ever recover. Just something for everyone out there to think about. Big show today. We're going to hit the most MLS-y things going down in Major League Soccer. I'll just coaching issues in Minnesota. I'll leave it there. Preseason friendlies at the Cotton Bowl. We'll hit that and have a little fun with it. But, of course, so much news happening around the league. All the latest news, we will run you through it. All the signings in free agency, the international signings, the rumors, all of it coming your way. A Charlotte deep dive. Dean Smith is the new manager, of course, and there's a big rumor about a number 10 for Charlotte that Mr. Tommy Scoops, Tom Boger, is reporting. So we'll do one deep dive on the show today, and that will be Charlotte FC. And then also run through open DP spots around Major League Soccer, as well as the CONCACAF Champions Cup, Group of 10 in MLS, which teams are the most prepared, which teams are the least, and of course we had to rank them. We start with some bad news. Doyle, some tragic news. Franz Beckenbauer passing away this morning, January 8th, at the age of 78, 4 years in NASL with the Cosmos, of course, a glowing career otherwise in Germany, with Germany, in international play, with clubs. He is a 1998 National Soccer Hall of Fame inductee, and rightfully so. His time was before my time, before I was born. You're our resident historian. Honor Franz Beckenbauer for us on today's pod.
I mean, his time was mostly before my time as well. At his absolute apex with Bayern Munich and West Germany in the late 60s and early 70s, he was second best player in the world.
You were a teenager in your 20s?
Thank you. Appreciate that, Andrew. He was the second best, or maybe the absolute best player in the world for a good long while. Won three or four straight Bundesliga titles with Bayern Munich, won, I think, seven overall with Bayern Munich, led them to three straight Champions League titles in the mid-70s, won the 72 Euros and the 74 World Cup with West Germany. If he never moved to the back line, we would probably still remember him as the best box-to-box or primarily defensive midfielder in the history of the game, because that's where he originally played, right? He was the first version of Lothar Matthäus, in that he ran the show from deep in central midfield. But in the late 60s, early 70s, he dropped to the back line and he became a sweeper. And Franz Beckenbauer, I think maybe more than any one player, rewrote the soccer meta in terms of what we expect from the game, how we expect the ball to be progressed upfield, who can do that and in what ways. There's a strong argument that the most exciting thing that any of us have ever seen in soccer was Beckenbauer getting on the ball 100 yards from goal and just going and carrying the ball upfield, evading tackle after tackle, and then slipping a winger through up the flank, or even carrying it into the final third and having it. I mean, he scored 100 goals as a guy who was not an attacker. He played the beautiful game, and that's not something people really associate with those Bayern Munich teams or the West Germany teams of any era. They were known as the foils to Brazil, as the foils to, before Beckenbauer, as the foils to the great Hungarian team of the 50s that really played, the first version of total football. Beckenbauer made it beautiful, man. He is one of the all-timers. Anytime you're doing a greatest 11 to ever have played the game and you're doing it by position, you could have arguments at most other positions. I don't think you can have arguments about Franz Beckenbauer. I think he's the greatest who's ever played as a central defender. And he changed the game more at that position than I think anybody has changed the game as an individual at any position. Now, we've seen teams, I would argue that overall, the total football teams, and of course, Beckenbauer was the great antithesis, the West German teams were the great antithesis of those Cruyff total football sides. You could argue that they changed the game more collectively, or what, Pep did with Barcelona changed the game more collectively. But just as an individual, to me, Beckenbauer is the one. We were very lucky in the U.S. to have him come join the Cosmos. He was only 32 when he did. He was still, at the tail end of his prime. And look, the Cosmos are remembered as the greatest show on turf and winners, and that's justified, but they didn't win anything until Beckenbauer arrived. They had Pelé, and Pelé made it fun, but Beckenbauer made them win. He's one of the greatest who ever played the sport, and he left his mark here, and we're all grateful for it.
There are hundreds, there are thousands, millions, more accurately, of building blocks laid in our soccer culture, and sometimes I don't think North Americans, Canadians, give ourselves enough credit for the people, the level of expertise, the effort in the face of years of doubt. That was put in to grow this game to where it is and where it can go. And Franz Beckenbauer, decades ago, laid many of those blocks, and we lay him to rest today. Franz Beckenbauer passing away at age 78. Now, Ozzie Alonso played the game a different way, but I mentioned that Beckenbauer is in the National Soccer Hall of Fame. Ozzie Alonso retired from soccer today, Doyle. And for those of us that watched him in his prime, that there's a little bit of sadness in that. No doubt about it. Should Ozzie Alonso be a National Soccer Hall of Fame inductee?
First ballot? No, so? Like 100%? Yeah, he was the best.
I will remind you, Shalri Joseph is having trouble getting in right now.
Yeah, but that's absurd, right? We've gone over it on the show for a million years, how absurd the voting for the Hall of Fame has been. Shalri was the best central midfielder in MLS for 6-7 years. Ozzie was the best defensive midfielder in MLS for close to a decade. He was the centerpiece of a Sounders team that won 4 U.S. Open Cups, a Shield, and the 2016 MLS Cup. He did everything that you would want from a first division player. He was an absolute star. He played D-mid in the way that I think you want it to be played if you're a coach or you're a fan. Like, yeah, he was the nastiest ball winner in the league for a good long while, but he also passed the hell out of the ball. Everything about Ozzie is Hall of Fame. Everything. It's not a question. Back 10 years ago, when you were first on the show, Weeby, if you were listing the 10 best players in MLS, you were absolutely saying Ozzie Alonso was one of them. And for the only time on that show, Simon would have agreed with you, right? That is the type of player he was, at a position that doesn't get a lot of glory. Ozzie is probably the best defensive midfielder in MLS history.
Hall Just of one fame. Best 11.
Yeah,
it's, that's an indictment of the best 11, not yeah. Ozzie Alonso. But yeah, I'll be doing my damnedest to get Ozzie a little bit of love in those National Soccer Hall of Fame chats. Shout out to Ozzie Alonso, to Simon Borg, to Jam Spoons, to Malta, to stories that you didn't know where they were going, but they cracked you up anyway. All-Stars, Best 11 players, incredible extra time hosts from a slightly different era. This era, though, big news, biggest news in Major League Soccer. According to French media, Denis Bouanga says he wants to return to Europe, either to France or another European club. Quote, my objective is clear and stated. I would like to come back and play in France or in a European club. Clear and stated, Doyle. 38 goals. What do you think he's saying? My spider sense here is show me the money.
Yeah, I think...
show me the money, John Thorington.
The EJ or the D-Row gif is appropriate right here.
Get those fingers up. Start rubbing them together.
According to MLSPA, Denis Bouanga made just under $2.5 million last year in guaranteed compensation, which is... tidy sum of money. I would take that, but Denis Bouanga is a lot better than me. He scored 38 goals. He's coming back to the table. The LAFC are built around him. He knows that. Anybody who watches them play know that.
They don't have any other DPs right now. Carlos Vela's out of contract.
Yeah, and they never filled their third. They never filled their third DP slot last year.
Yeah, if you're his agent and you are coming into this offseason, you're using every single tool you have. You are busting out the pry bar, and you are wiggling it around. You are just using the media, as they clearly are in this case. Like you got to take advantage. You got to hit while the iron is hot, and it is absolutely red hot for Denis Bouanga. And he's underpaid. He's underpaid. Based on his ability and his production and his importance to LAFC, he's underpaid.
I think that's the entirety of the story. Now, if somebody comes in with a $20 million bid, then the story changes. But I don't think there are any French teams who are spending that type of money aside from PSG. Now, there are Saudi teams. There are teams in the UAE or Qatar, but I don't think we've crossed that bridge
but
yet.
But didn't he say, and maybe I'm reading into a quote that I'm only somewhat aware of the origins of. The words I would underline, my objective is clear and stated. So the stated is important there. He's saying, I've said to LAFC what I would like. And what I would like is to be in France or a European club. So we had heard some other rumors about Saudi before then. And when you're talking about, to your point, the big transfer fees right now, that would be a place that he could perhaps go. This is one to monitor. The entire offseason for LAFC is one to monitor. Back-to-back MLS Cup appearances. Don't know about Carlos Vela. Don't know about Kellen Acosta. We'll get to that in a little bit in free agency. Apparently, the Chicago Fire are in for Kellen Acosta. That's floating around. How big is this offseason? Because gone is Giorgio Chiellini. You got to go get a new left back. Chiqui Palacios is gone as well. There's a ton of young players that could be great, but haven't yet shown that sort of level. And Hugo Lloris. How would you grade this offseason so far for LAFC?
I mean, massively incomplete and starting to be a little bit worrying. I do like their attack, provided that they can keep Bouanga. I'm not sure I would bring Vela back as a DP. They have to figure that out. The number nine slot, like they spent on Mario Gonzalez. He did not work out. Is he a David Goss theorem guy? Perhaps. But it didn't. He didn't look great last year. The midfield, we know that Bogusz has talent. He was not consistent. Ilya is approaching his mid-30s. Timothy Tillman had good moments, but he had moments where he would disappear, especially defensively, which is tough for a team that wants to press high and win the ball. It's a lot of question marks. It's weirdly disjointed for a team that has been to two straight MLS Cups. Now, I'm not, nobody's going to write them off. We shouldn't make that mistake, and nobody should think that we're doing it. But they're not in as strong a position as you would have expected. And what has compounded that over the last couple of years is they have not done a great job of develop and sell. They didn't get anything for Chiqui Palacios, which is weird. They got less for Jose Cifuentes than I think we all expected. They weren't able to sell Eddie Atuesta at the peak of his value. They ended up getting less than I think we expected as well. We know that Brian Rodriguez didn't work out. Christian Oliveira has looked good so far, but he hasn't been productive. All on down the list, it hasn't been great for LAFC. And when they rebuilt that roster 2 years ago, They did it by getting guys like Kellen Acosta and Maxime Crépeau, guys from within MLS and guys who have since left for free. It's tough to look at it and be as confident this window as I think LAFC fans were two windows ago following that 2022 MLS Cup Supporter Shield double. It just doesn't look great.
Mamadou Fall is a name I would throw in there as well. Developed, and then it's sort of been a seesaw so far. LAFC right now trying to figure things out. There's a possibility that they would have zero designated players on this roster. I would argue a very low possibility. Denny Bawanga is under contract, and if you're John Thorington, you're seeing the headlines, and you're saying, okay, I get it. You would like to be paid more. We would like to keep you, but you are under contract. We'll see how this one shakes out. Most MLS-y thing of the offseason so far, at least the last couple days, I saw the headlines, and I could have sworn that this was a regular season game. It's not. FC Dallas are going to host Lionel Messi and Inter Miami at the Cotton Bowl in preseason. Is this the most high-profile preseason game of all time, Matt Doyle?
I mean, probably.
A preseason game at the Cotton Bowl. I have watched a lot of preseason soccer. Hell, you can't watch a lot of preseason soccer. It is literally impossible. It's behind closed doors and not streamed. And FC Dallas is going to host Messi at the freaking Cotton Bowl.
Is this one going to be streamed?
I don't know. That might downgrade the ticket price. I don't know. Anybody can see it. What do you got to pay to get in? No, I'm just kidding. Should be fun. Should be a carnival-like atmosphere. And I'm pretty sure that the Texas State Fair is actually surrounding the Cotton Bowl. So maybe indeed it will be a carnival-type atmosphere. How about this for an MLS-y thing? Coaching vacancies. Donjo hit us up and said, have you ever seen an interim leave for another interim to be announced just before the season? And why does this mean Minnesota United have the league right where they want them? If you missed the news, Sean McCauley was the last non-permanent head coach in Major League Soccer. All the other managerial slots had been filled. Sean McCauley, lame duck interim, this last week departed Minnesota United to, quote, pursue other opportunities. It is now Cameron Knowles, formerly the Minnesota United 2 head coach, that is the interim head coach. Apparently, Khalid El-Amin gets there this week, and they would like to have a head coach in place in the next 6 weeks or so, which is, you know, if you plot it out here, basically around opening day. This cannot have been the plan.
It's weird. It is very strange because they signed Khalid El-Amin as the chief soccer.
I was thinking the UConn point guard.
Absolutely. I appreciated that, Weeby. I was there with you. They signed him as a chief soccer officer back in early October. He's had the job for 3 months. Now, granted, he was still sort of winding down at Barnsley, but I find it difficult to believe that he didn't spend any time at all during that three-month period between now and then. Thinking about who the head coach should be.
Wouldn't a primary part of the interview process to become the chief soccer officer of a club without a head coach be your viewpoint and potential candidate pool for that head coaching position?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That would be one of the first questions that you would have to answer and present on. It's how you are going to be measured.
Well, maybe that's why Sean McCauley left, right? Maybe he was told or got wind of the fact that actually a coaching decision has already been made and they're just going to wait to put, you know, dot the I's and cross the T's over the next couple of weeks now that Khalid El-Amin is in town.
If Sean McCauley was not a realistic candidate for the first team job permanently moving forward, I can't see a reason why Sean McCauley would want to sit around and do that interim job. I don't understand what he would get out of playing a preseason.
So I'll push back. No, I'll push back on that because the idea is you're betting on yourself. The reason you take the interim job is because, okay, I am planning the preseason and it is going to be my team for 2 months. And if I go 6-0-2, they're going to have a tough time walking away from me.
If you know there's a hire coming in 6 weeks or they want to hire someone before the start of the season and you don't even get to coach a game?
I mean, well, that is different. Right? That would explain him walking away. Right. But if it was, you know what, I'm actually going to have this job till early May, then it's like, yeah, I'm going to bet on myself. So it, like, to me, I understand that the messaging has been, frankly, kind of poor from Minnesota, and it's the fans are understandably kind of scratching their heads, though I do understand that the Wonderwall, the fan base there, have had meetings with some club executives, and they came away from those meetings feeling more confident in the direction of the team. At the same time, I look at this and I see they have an MVP caliber number 10. They have Timu Pukki as the number 9, and he was super productive last year. I have all my Bongi stock. Robin Lud back on the left wing or playing as a number 8. The pieces are in place in that attack to be really good. It is going to be a desirable job. And if they get this higher right, this is going to be, I think, a very good team in 2024. It's been weird. The whole thing with how it happened with you know, down the stretch with Adrian Heath getting fired and then not having a permanent replacement. And Adrian Heath was essentially the entire organization, right? There was no infrastructure
from a beside soccer perspective.
Him from a soccer perspective. So just having to build up some institutional knowledge now makes it feel like they are running up against the clock, and they're kind of acting like it a little bit, but the pieces are still in place for this team to be very good. And if Khalid El Ahmad gets the higher right, then Minnesota is going to be a lot of fun to watch in 2024.
I completely agree with you. To me, this is a win now team, the way the mm-hmm. squad is constructed, the money Absolutely. That's been spent at the 9 and the 10 position, the veteran presences they have both in the midfield, on the wings, at center back. That's why it's so strange that they weren't sort of ready with the dominoes after letting Adrian Heath go while they were still alive, could still qualify for the postseason.
Yeah.
You would have thought that the reason for making that decision was, one, you didn't want to have the miracle happen and then Adrian Heath sort of lay claim to that spot going forward. You were going to make the change, but also that you understood how things were lined up and you were pushing the first domino and the rest of them would fall sort of in a timely manner. Right now, that domino is still standing. But, hey, if a coach can get in there before the first game or even in the first month, it's Major League Soccer, man. You get hot at the right time. You get into the playoffs with the amount of talent they have. Certainly, they could go win something, but it just feels a little bit off the rails right now. Minnesota United not in the CONCACAF Champions Cup. There are 10 teams in Major League Soccer who are, and Paul hit us up and said, of our Champions Cup-bound teams, which is the most ready and which has the most prep work to do this month? The first game is coming up a month away. Vancouver Whitecaps hosting Tigres at beautiful Starlight Stadium. Most of the other opening games for MLS teams happen around February 20th, 21st. Of course, MLS opening day is on the 21st, a Wednesday. RSL Inter Miami. I looked up Starlight Stadium, had not seen it before. Pacific FC plays there, Doyle. 6,000 seats. It is beautiful. It is so sick that Tigres is going to come play Vancouver on this turf. Let's rank and let's tier teams in terms of preparation for Champions Cup. And we have a top tier that consists of two teams. Which teams are those?
Inter Miami and Columbus Crew. And Inter Miami is obvious. Well, I think we should start with them because I think as great as the Crew are and were in the playoffs, this Inter Miami roster is absurd. Messi is on the right wing. Luis Suarez, who was the player of the year in Brazil last year, is center forward. Robert Taylor's at the left wing. Then they have...
Oh, that's sick, by the way. That's sick.
It's absurd.
Just breezed through that, but like Robert Taylor. The left wing. How awesome is that for Robert Taylor?
It's so great, but it's also like, this is a guy who instantly understood what the job was. And we were doing a Leagues Cup wrap-up show. Yep. And it was, I think, after the second game. It was after the Atlanta game. And that we got Robert Taylor on the field for an interview after the show. And I think it was Katie Witham asked him, he's like, so, you know, what have you done to, you know, make sure that you are gelling with Lionel Messi and Sergio Busquets? And he's like, anytime they get the ball, four of us run. And like, that's it. That is the job.
Robert Taylor's special skill is he knows where to run to. Apparently.
Exactly. His timing's very good. So it's either him or Farias on the left side. And those guys are starters at 25 MLS teams. It's, you know, they have their choice in central midfield of Kramaski and Julian Gressel and Gregory and Jean Mota, and Diego Gomez and David Ruiz, who the academy kid who I thought was just as impressive as Kramaski. They have Busquets at defensive midfield, and if he can't go, they have Mota to play as a regista, or they have Gregory to play as a destroyer. They have DeAndre Yedlin or Gressel at right back. They have Jordi Alba or Franco Negri or Noah Allen at left back. Drake Callender was a star at times in goal. I think center back is the one place I'm a little bit worried. Kristoff was, I thought, very good, but he needs a little bit of protection in terms of field coverage. He and Aviles didn't necessarily have the chemistry that I'd want to see, so they will give up goals. But think about what I just listed off for their attackers. It's absurd. This is the most stacked lineup that we've ever seen in MLS, period.
On the flip side, the Crew just won a championship. They have a style of play that worked in the playoffs to great effect. They will give up goals as well, but have brought basically the entire team back. All the key contributors, re-signed Arlington Nagbe, made some big moves as far as depth pieces to help them in this busy section to start.
Can I interrupt? Because they made an under-the-radar signing that I absolutely freaking love, which is Derek Jones.
Oh, I knew.
Yeah.
See, that I was getting ready to filibuster just so you could break in. Run to the dais to give us your Derek Jones look.
So, like, Derek Jones, he's 6'4", incredible strength, incredible balance and body control, good soft feet, has gotten numerous chances at numerous other spots, and it hasn't really worked out for him in spite of all his tools and all his talent. This is a guy who 6 years ago was playing next to Tyler Adams in the U-20 World Cup in central midfield, and honestly, in that tournament, he was better than Tyler Adams. Now, he doesn't have the defensive and pressing instincts that Adams does, which nobody does. That's what differentiates Tyler Adams as a soccer player, and it's tough to match that. But in terms of what he did on the ball against the best young midfielders in the world, it was like the U.S. made it to the quarterfinals, and they were running things through Derek Jones. He has never been able, for one reason or another, been able to translate that consistently in MLS. I think we saw some of it down the stretch in 2022 in Charlotte under Christian Latanzio, where he was, okay, he's the number six. He's the back point of that three-man midfield, and he was tasked with protecting the back line and progressing the ball. But for whatever reason, Latanzio changed the game model pretty significantly in 2023, and there didn't end up being a good spot for Derek Jones.
Let me ask you, Derek Jones, on the depth chart that I have for the Crew, appears in a number of different places, either as a central midfielder. He could play for Nagbe or Morris the way they play. He could play at one of the outside center back spots. I could even see a possibility that they could put him under Rudy Camacho and say, hey, learn the ways of playing in the middle of this system where you need to be a communicator, you need to read the game, and be an efficient distributor both forward and unlock things on the wings. Where do you think his best position for Wilfred Nancy is?
So I could see him getting a chance at center back, either right center back or in the middle in the Camacho spot. But
Sean Zawadzki is one of those guys that got transitioned. Like that, Wilfred has been,
he's been willing to do that.
Yes, Admonson pushed inside into a center back. Marrera is not traditionally a center back, and now is a standout one.
Yeah, so it's not out of the question. But to me, I see him as the third man in the central midfield rotation behind Nagbe and Aiden Morris, and maybe sometimes ahead of those guys because of his ball security, because he is a 360-degree player. Like, the game can happen around him, and he can still influence it. And I just think this is a perfect type of talent to take a chance on if you have a head coach like Wilfred Nance, one who excels at getting the best out of players. It is a low risk, high reward move from the Crew. I absolutely love it. I cannot wait to see him play for this Columbus team. He's going to be 27 in March or April. So he's not a kid anymore. And this is kind of like last chance hotel. But if you're getting a last chance, this is the team, this is the coach you want to have that last chance with.
And if you were looking for a player to potentially take a leap, Marino Hinostroza might be that guy from Pachuca. He's a left winger by trade, but the way the Crew are going to play, it's more like left wing back.
Yep.
Seems like someone to compete with Yaya Boa, who had his moment in MLS Cup, but had a number of less shining moments, let's say, throughout the year. The big question mark for the Crew, there really is only one, and it is Mo Farsi at right back.
Yeah. They don't have a backup for him either right now because they did lose Julian Gressel in free agency.
Well, check that Crew 2 roster. Have to go do some MLS Next Pro research. But those are our top two, Inter Miami and Columbus. And our next tier, staying in Ohio, FC Cincinnati. Some changes for them. Our Instagram reporting tells us that one Brandon Vasquez is on his way to Monterrey. That 7.5 to up to 8.5 million move seems to be chugging along. Orlando City also in this second tier for us. And then the Philadelphia Union. For me, Doyle, the Union are holding on by a thread here.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it would be Cincinnati and Orlando City. And I would maybe even argue that the Revs or Nashville would be hard done by to not be in the same place as the Union. Maybe there's a third tier that they're smashed into. Which of these three teams do you think has the best shot? Cincinnati's got Cavalier to start, maybe Monterrey on the other side. Orlando City start with Cavalry from up north, and then perhaps Tigres on the other side, a rematch from last year. And Philadelphia knows Saprissa well, and they'll take them on in this first round.
Yeah, I'm with you on Philly. I think that I argued for them to be in this tier based upon their track record. Right? They've gotten to the CCL semifinals twice in the past 3 years. They do a really good job of developing young players. I think we saw Jack McGlynn, Nathan Harriel, and Quinn Sullivan all take a step last year. So in theory, they have more depth. They have more chances to put guys in position to be difference makers. And that has been the gap where they haven't had the elite of the elite in the region, which is why they end up finishing in the semifinals instead of making it to the final and maybe pushing to win. Maybe Julian Carranza, who they haven't sold yet, takes that leap this year. Maybe it is Ty Baribo having a David Goss theorem type of season. It's a lot of maybes. I'm not counting on it to happen, but just because their defense is so good, they have so much depth, if they're able to re-sign Kai Wagner and Ali Bedoya, like, they have earned us putting them in this second tier.
Kai Wagner would be the key for me.
Yeah.
Just in terms of difference makers. I know with the Union, it's easy to focus on the front three and what they bring, but all the service.
Yeah.
Comes from Kai Wagner. There are missing parts for Orlando City, and no Nico Ladero's in free agency, but Mauricio Pereira ran things for them, and when he ran things, particularly at home, they looked very good. When they didn't have that presence in midfield, they didn't.
So I think in terms of replacing Pereira and what he does, I think Ladero is a better version of him. If they want to be the same team they were last year, Ladero, he fits that bill. He makes them that team, except I think a little bit better. If they want to be truly elite, they have to figure out how to use that third DP slot to get a Bello Reynoso or Carlos Heel level number 10. And that's tough because the way their roster is constructed, neither Facu Torres nor Martin Ojeda are young DPs and neither can be bought down. And they're using all three of their U22 slots. So the number 10 that I think they should go out and get, and the like, that guy is the difference between Orlando City as a really good 63-point team and Orlando City as potentially the best team in the league, potentially the best team in North America. I think they have the pieces to get that. It has to be a young DP. So it has to be someone 23 or under.
Imagine being an Orlando fan and hearing you say the difference between these two things is 63 points or the best team in North America. What a different existence that is. For Orlando.
I mean, that's why Oscar Pereja is still there, right? We remember what they were for 5 years before
that
the current
like
brain
an absurdity
trust. Yeah.
Even a few years ago. Just
absolutely.
Just unbelievable.
But this team, this roster is stacked. I do think they need a starting right center back as well. I don't think Rodrigo Schlegel is an elite center back. He's a very good third center back in the league. But they sold Antonio Carlos to, I think, Fluminense for $500,000. They have a spot that they need to address there. But to me, the big one is use that third DP on an elite young number 10 who can elevate everyone around him and be a true chance creator. And if they get that player in, then Orlando is not in this second tier. Orlando's in the first tier.
Thiago Almada is a name that jumps to mind. I'm not saying Orlando are going to go out and spend that type of money, but they need an impact player in that position, to your point. FC Cincinnati looking for an impact forward as well. Looks like Corey Barrett is headed their way in free agency. We'll get to that in a little bit. That's really the hole for Cincinnati. Miles Robinson came in and filled a big one that we saw in the playoffs, but you know, it's Bupenza, it's Lucho, and who up top? And there's a question mark about Alvaro Barreal that is yet to be answered. Reports are that he would like to go to Europe, and the number would be $6 million to get him there, but no solid bids at this point. So that's the gap for Cincinnati, in my opinion. The other thing is, there's Monterrey on the other side. I don't care who you are. Beating Monterrey, Tigres, America in Champions Cup, you're always against those odds. And then our bottom tier, we got five teams here. The Revs, Nashville, Vancouver Whitecaps, Houston Dynamo, and St. Louis City. Who's the most likely to make a surprising run out of these five?
Oh, man. I would say Vancouver if they weren't starting with Tigres. And I know that Vancouver won't play scared because we saw them match up against Tigres in the League's Cup, and they took them to penalties, and they played, I thought, very good ball in that one. But anytime you're going up against the Monterrey clubs or Club America, you're at a talent disadvantage. So that one's tough.
And you're going to do it on less than a month of preseason?
Yep. It's difficult. St. Louis City, even though in terms of talent, I don't rate them as highly as some of the other clubs, they play a style against the ball that translates really well early in the season, because it's just harder to use the ball. You need reps, you need rhythm, than it is to play against the ball. And I think we saw that at their start of last year. And their first two teams they're playing are Houston, and if they get past Houston, then it'll be Columbus. And those are two possession teams. Possession teams make mistakes that you can feast off of early in the season. I'm not saying that this is an easy path, but it is a path that I think does play to their strengths as a team.
I have a hard time seeing any of these teams making a run. The Revs are on a good side of the bracket. That's what I'll say.
The Revs are on a good side of the bracket, and they have the things that you usually look for in terms of a roster that fits together. It revolves around Carlos Hill, and with Dylan Barrero coming back and Thomas Chankalai, they have two goal-scoring wingers. They have depth and experience at defensive midfield. They have depth and experience at fullback, though obviously they will miss Brandon Bye. They have depth and experience at center back, though I do not think they're elite there. They have pieces that make sense together. The question mark is Giacomo Vrioni. He's a DP number nine who has never played like it. If the Revs are able to say, you know what, we missed on this one, let's move on, and then, I don't know, go bring back Adam Buxa or something, that elevates them at least to the second tier, just because they have so many good pieces, Weeby.
There's going to be chances. Yeah. Caleb Porter did make a point of saying in his opening press conference with the Revs that he likes Vrioni, that he thinks Vrioni can do the job, and that if he didn't, he wouldn't sit on that podium and say it. Now, look, it's a press conference for the first time as you hired a manager of a club. Like, you can't come out and say, we would like to sell Giacomo Vrioni. That doesn't put you in a position to do it. But maybe he can help revive a guy who clearly has talent but just hasn't quite fit in with what the Revs are trying to do. The other issue is on the back at goalkeeper. They made a signing. Henrik Ravas The Slovakian coming over from Poland has been a starter for the past 2.5 years or so in Poland, helped his team get promoted to the first division, had a very good first season in the first division, and he's having an okay one now. So I think he's facing a lot of shots, let's just say, if the stats are to be believed here. But they have a good track record outside Vašlík when it comes to scouting goalkeepers. It's just that Vašlík was an abject disaster. So let's wait and see what Ravas is about. Don't got to scout Dax McCarty, though, Doyle. Free agents. Tommy Scoop saying Dax is going to sign with Atlanta United, the grand tradition of a veteran ginger holding down defensive midfield for this Atlanta team. I mean, leads to titles, has in the past. What do you think about Dax to Atlanta? How big of a role is this going to be for him?
I love it. I think it's probably like, all right, Dax, we need you for 2,000 minutes across all competitions. Because Atlanta United are the type of team with this roster that are going to go into every competition this year expecting to compete and win. That has to be the goal, trophies. And Dax is not 26 anymore. He's 36. He's not going to give you 4,000 minutes, but he can give you 2,000 good ones. And we saw that with Nashville last year. He was really, really good for most of the season, especially during that League's Cup run. If you go back and watch those games, so much of what Nashville did well came from Dax progressive third line passes into the pockets to get Hani Mukhtar on the ball in good spots. Once he ran out of gas, which basically happened after the League's Cup, Nashville were much less dynamic.
They were
much
shell.
Less. They were yeah, they were shell of themselves.
Like, let's just be straight up about it. I remember in the later parts of the season watching Nashville, watching the results string together, and it was a team that, I mean, they fell off a cliff. Hani fell off a cliff. His production cratered. Sam Surridge, the guy that we saw sort of take the steps that we thought would result in, you know, the player that they had been looking for and had paid for, that sort of evaporated as well. And that's the risk for Nashville of relying on Anibal Godoy and Dax McCarty in central midfield to build the game for you.
Yeah. He's been elite at that wherever he's gone. It's still in his bag. You just have to be smart about managing his minutes. The other thing is, look, teams that win tend to have veterans in the locker room. And Dax has won a lot in MLS. He's never won MLS Cup, but he's been there. And he's won supporter shields, and he's, you know, been to finals. It's the type of guy that, as long as he is bought in and understanding of his role as a veteran mentor and not necessarily a first choice guy, it's a no brainer of a signing. And the only question I have about it is, why didn't Orlando do this? Dax is from Orlando, and Orlando was this close to being, like, we were just saying, 70-point, maybe the best team in North America. Like, that's where Orlando is. Dax would have fit perfectly for them. So I think it's great work from Atlanta. I think it's a missed opportunity for Orlando City.
I think the need is more acute for Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing about...
There are culture setters already in Orlando. Look at this roster for Atlanta. Outside of Brad Guzan, players who have won in this league. Is there one?
Yeah, there's not a lot, are there?
There's not a single one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Derek Etienne.
There you go.
Yeah, Derek Etienne, but not a starter. Dax McCarty is a guy who brings something completely different. I think his ability to progress the ball from those deep-lying areas really sets things up for Thiago Almada, Saba, Silva. And you just need 2,000 minutes. Maybe this is an opportunity then to the Nico Ladero and young DP discussion on Orlando to get a different profile of six. To go get a younger guy that you can use Dax as a mentor for.
Right. It makes a lot of sense in that way. It also maybe gives them the leeway to push that decision back to the summer.
Yeah.
Which is something that Garth Lagerwey has traditionally liked to do. He doesn't like to make a lot of moves in the winter transfer window. I mean, we saw it last year. They brought in Saba Lubchenitsa, Jean De Silva, and Tristan Moyumba during the summer window. All three of those guys worked out really well. Dax next to Moyumba is actually really good as well, because Dax can sit and protect, and that would allow Moyumba to go out and seek the ball and win the ball all over the field. So it's just it's a great. I think it's a great signing. It's a type of signing that the smart soccer team makes.
Yeah, it gives a good platform to Gregerson on the back line and Abram as well. That center back pairing is going to be a big question mark for Atlanta. How about Corey Baird to FC Cincinnati? Is that a fit for you?
To me, it is. I'm not sure I see him as a starter, but we've watched Corey Baird 5 years now, and he's had a lot of very good moments, but always as a winger or as a center forward in a three. We've never seen him play up top with a partner, and to me, he's the prototypical second forward, where you don't necessarily want him out wide going 1v1, but you don't mind if he drifts wide centrally. You don't want him occupying center backs, but you don't mind if he's in the box sort of drifting to the back post. And he scored 14 goals for Houston last year, and all of them, it seems like, were drifting to the back post off of somebody else's combination play. So I think he fits in terms of a two. I'm not sure he fits next to Boupenza, because usually in a two, one of the center forwards, one of the two forwards, will occupy the center backs and the other will find space. And I'm not sure that Boupenza, I mean, I, from what I saw last year, Boupenza does not want to occupy space.
That's not Boupenza. The thing that does fit is Boupenza does want to occupy the ball. He would like to be on the ball, and so would Lucho, in having another striker, attacker, wherever and however they play him, that doesn't really need the ball, because Corey Baird didn't really need the ball in the Houston system either. He more impacted things with his movement, with his positioning. I mean, that is a fit. But I do agree with you that there's space here for another starting caliber forward. Now, the issue is Brandon Vasquez's cap number was so efficient, let's say, cap-wise for Cincinnati, that it's going to be very hard to replace that production. But it does give you an opportunity to go look for a little bit of potential to say, hey, take your time getting up to speed here. You don't need to be a 20-goal scorer from the start. And to the Dax point as well, pushes that down to the summer. If you've got Sergio Santos, Boupenza, Baird, maybe Dombaji, maybe, question mark on that one, you can survive until the summer and figure it out from there. But I'm very curious to see what Corey Baird does with Cincinnati. Now, the flip side is Sebas Ferreira is apparently returning to the Houston Dynamo. We were going to kick this can down the road to the DP discussion, but let's just do it now. Would you trade Corey Baird for Sebas Ferreira? Doesn't seem like the Dynamo had any choice. Baird decided where he wanted to go. But boy, it's time for Ferreira to come good or get going.
Yeah, I will be surprised if he's still on this roster at the start of the season. He scored some goals in his first season, but they got rid of him for a reason. They loaned him out to, I think it was Vasco da Gama, in Brazil's top flight. He didn't score a goal in 13 appearances. The Dynamo have Ache. They have Artur. They have a window of opportunity to be a title-winning team again, because they won the Open Cup last year. I don't think they get there if Sebastian Ferreira is their number nine. So they're going to have to either find another loan, one that hopefully opens up a DP slot, not hopefully, one that absolutely opens up a DP slot, or they're going to have to sell him, or they're just going to have to bite the bullet, because the window will close as Hector Herrera ages. They have to get it done this year, and he's not part of that.
The nice thing for them on the DP front is they don't need to move Ferreira to have a DP signing. Teenage Adebi is gone, so there is an open DP spot. It's just so frustrating for a player who clearly isn't destined to be a part of your project or wasn't invested in trying to be last preseason, is taking up that space. There is a goal-scoring chasm, let's say, for the Houston Dynamo. It was an issue at times last year. Who was it going to be? It's still there. They got to find a number nine. Maxime Crépeau to Portland. We wondered where Maxime would land. I, being an idiot, suggested the Revs when there was already an existing and verified rumor out there. Good try by me. Clearly, their goalkeeper was needed for the Revs. Just they already had one in mind. But the Timbers have remade their goalkeeper room after issues, let's say, last year with a number of goalkeepers, both arguing publicly with Gio Savarese and also not performing at the level that they'd like. So Maxime Crépeau is the starter in Portland. James Pantemis is in from Montreal, Trey Muse is in from well. Everybody's looking around at each other saying, we're in the same boat. What do you think about Craig Poe as the Portland starter?
It makes sense to me. I don't think he's goalkeeper of the year material, but I do think when he's healthy, he's one of the 10 best probably goalkeepers in MLS. And the Portland guys were nowhere near that level last year. So I think he represents an upgrade. And you're not going to win MLS Cup or much of anything, really, if you don't have a very good starting goalkeeper. So I think they upgraded that spot. And by getting Kamal Miller, they upgraded the left center back spot as well. And just so happened that they're starting left center back, they're starting goalkeeper, and I think Zach McGraw will probably be their starting right center back. All three guys with a Canadian champion or a Canadian national team. So there has to be some chemistry, which is good, because the Portland team we saw the last couple of years had zero chemistry. I mean, even going back to 2021, when they made it to MLS Cup, that team, their defense was just, you know, drop the line into the box and clear everything. That was it. Like, there was nothing that was organized and applicable further upfield you moved. So this bodes well for a Portland team that will hopefully be more solid and put together and able to play the game from back to front. Even if, I mean, Kripo's not anything special with his feet, but just understanding how the players in front of you want to play is just a massive step for the Timbers, who had nothing like that in the last couple of years.
We wondered a lot about LAFC's DP situation. Evander, the subject of Brazilian bids, that market clearly heating up between MLS and Brazil, and two open DP spots for the Timbers. What would you be thinking if you were them with those spots?
A young DP left winger and a more proven left winger and a young DP number 9, because that allows access to all the U22 roster slots. I don't think they should be interested in selling Evander unless Flamengo comes back with it, absolutely blows them away with an offer, which they did not in their first offer. But because they have Felipe Mora on the roster as a number 9, I think that allows them to go a little younger and less proven at that spot. And because they have in Evander and Santi Moreno, two very good chance creators already in the starting lineup, you can go with more of a goal-scoring inverted left winger at that spot. And those guys, they're not cheap, but they're out there.
Yeah, the nice thing is at that left wing spot as well, you really only need production from February to September.
Because then you have Dairon time.
Dairon comes in October, yeah. And then it's all good from then on out. So that makes it a little bit simpler. Callan Kehoe says, please give us anything on what to expect from Phil Neville. He's the one new coach I feel like there's been no extra time coverage on. We'll hit that in just a minute. We're going to rank the degree of difficulty for new head coaches around MLS. I want to throw this at you, Doyle, because it's floating around MLS Twitter. Kellen Acosta to the Chicago Fire. Make the case for the Fire, why they would want Kellen, and then at the backside of that, I want you to make the case for why Kellen Acosta would want to go for the Fire, and you can't just say money.
So, for the Fire, it's easy, right? They have constantly overlooked players from within the league. The value of institutional know-how from within MLS, guys who know how to win. And Kellen Acosta knows how to win. He's showed it throughout his career, going back to his time with FC Dallas, his time with Colorado, his time with LAFC. They made two MLS Cups in 2 years, won one of them. He all the stuff we said about Dax applies to Kellen, except Kellen's 28 and he's in the prime of his career. It is a no-brainer for the Fire if you can get him on a long-term deal. You plug him into that midfield and you keep him there for a good long while. For Kellen, obviously it's a tougher sell because the Fire have been a disaster for so long. But if I was him, I'd say, I'm signing with you to play the number 6. And that's because being the number 6 is the best way for him to, A, maximize his skill set as a player, and B, stay in the picture for the U.S. national team. Now, we saw him play at the World Cup 13 months ago. He was pretty good as a 6 and sometimes as an 8, but if you look at the U.S. roster, there is a gap behind Tyler Adams, assuming that Tyler Adams is ever healthy again, there is a gap behind Tyler Adams as the number six, as the guy who you can plug in when Adams is on a yellow or when he needs rest. And if you play that position every week at a good level, you will put yourself back into the mix. So I think that is the sell for Kellen Acosta. And personally, I think it works for the Fire because they still have Federico Navarro, who I like a lot as a ball winner, but not as a game manager. So I think a midfield
of Kellen, Fede Navarro, and Brian Gutierrez.
It's a fun midfield,
man. That's fun. And then if you go get, look, this is the issue for the Fire. Shaqiri has underperformed. Jairo Torres is non-existent as a DP. You got to find a way to either get something out of him or move him on. But the issues for them remain, hey, top end, you still probably need a DP 9 or a goal-scoring 9. Fill in the blank. Find one. Tom Barlow is a good depth piece. Kutsias had signs last year, but come on, you're not going to have either of the guys, you know, carry things. And then it's Haile Selassie, Erbers, and what on the left wing? Like, the Fire just, they remain incomplete to me.
Yeah.
Very incomplete. Now, there are rumors about a new center back, Tobias Salquist from Denmark in his late 20s. Seems like a good signing, especially if Carlos Turan is serious about trying to get out of there and go to Europe. So we'll see on that one. Other signings from around the league, St. Louis City continues to remake their outside back spots from Scandinavia. This time they go to Denmark for a youth international left back, Nicholas Dyer from Michelin. 103 appearances already for this left back. So, hey, two young black left backs, Totland at right back as well. So that's a good business for them. Red Bulls finalizing a deal to sign a Sweden youth international center back, Noah Isle from Malmo. Likely a U22 initiative signing. And as always, Tom Bogert is basically reporting all of this.
There are going to be, from what I understand, there's going to be a number of Red Bull signings coming in the next couple of weeks. Like, they're actually making the moves that they have promised to make for a good long while. It's actually happening for the Red Bulls. So I think there's going to start to be some optimism in a fan base that has maybe been without that for a good long while.
All right, let's get to Charlotte. Hit a deep dive here. Mark Fishkin hit us up. He of Seeing Red fame. Speaking of the Red Bulls, which first-year coach has the biggest challenge ahead of him? We ranked these. Hardest job is John Herdman. Sadly for John. And then we have Minnesota Hire at 2, Montreal at 3, Chris Armas at 4 with the Rapids, Sandra Schwartz with the Red Bulls at 5, Troy Lesane at 6, Phil Neville at 7, Dean Smith at 8, and Caleb Porter. We have the least difficult job for Caleb with the Revs because that roster is pretty well set up. But Dean Smith, in ranking him 8th here in difficulty, are we saying it as an easy job? What do you expect from year 1 of Dino in MLS?
It's tough to... I found it very difficult to do that ranking bit that we did in the pre-show meeting.
That's why I just listed it.
Yeah. No. I'm glad that you and Anders had fun with it. Just looking at this roster, there are pieces in place that make sense. The big issue for Charlotte last year were injuries, right? And they're getting Guzman Carujo back, and he was essential for them in 2022. And I think he elevates their back line. An incomplete roster. Well, they've kind of fixed that, especially left back and deep midfield. Those were issues last year that stayed unresolved until the middle of the season. And then performance of their top end players. Their DPs just have not been good enough. And Enzo Capetti, Karol Swiderski, and especially Kamil Joswiak, like, they're not answers in MLS. I like Swiderski a lot, but he's not really a number 9, and we haven't seen him really be a number 10. He's kind of a 9.5. He would fit best in a team that plays with two up top, which, by the way, he does for Poland when he plays off of Robert Lewandowski, who's maybe the best pure striker of the past generation.
Would you sell Swiderski if Serie A came in or the Bundesliga came in with a number that's in the general zone of what you paid for him?
I probably would. I like him as a player, but he just hasn't quite fit. Capetti, I think, is a true number nine. He wasn't great last year, but he's an easy fit for a manager who wants to play a 4-2-3-1, which is what Dean Smith has mostly done throughout his career. Jizviak, like, you just have to figure out a way to get out of that contract. Because
wasn't there a moment early in the Jizviak negotiations where he had an injury and there seemed like a very clear out?
Yes.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Hindsight's 2020, huh?
Yeah. Hopefully the brain trust will not make that mistake again. But I like what they have behind that number 10 spot in central midfield. Provided Carujo is the guy he was before the injury, I like their center backs. Adelson Milanda will need to take a step forward this year. He has the talent to do so. Christian Colino was not great in 2022, but he was very good last year. Their fullbacks are kind of no frills. Can they upgrade the top end of the roster? If they do that, then Dean Smith, I think, will have a very good year, because the thing about him as a manager is that his teams didn't overcomplicate things. They plucked the low-hanging fruit, and there's a lot of low-hanging fruit here in MLS. If you get your team ready to play every single week and everybody's clear about what their roles are, then you're going to end up on 45 to 50 points. And if they get those top end signings right, then I think that's within the grasp of this year's Charlotte team.
We'll get to those signings in a second, because there's a big rumor coming out of Norway about a young Danish youth international, perhaps a $9.5 million bid. The flip side is, here's a quote stood out to me on Dean Smith in his press conference, an introduction, quote, "My job is to develop players. If I develop players, then the team develops. Many of the players at Aston Villa still sing his praises, including one not at Aston Villa anymore, Jack Grealish. Ollie Watkins, another of those guys. There's a number of players that developed, and certainly that would be the case as Villa were promoted under Dean Smith's watch and then managed to stay in the Premier League. But you look at this roster, Ben Bender, Ajiman, Kerwin Vargas, Milanda. There's a bunch of players here that seem like they have a higher ceiling that he could help them reach. Maybe he's more in control of that than the top-end talent, but it certainly seems like man management is one of Dean Smith's strengths. And I just think about the first couple years in MLS for Charlotte and a sense of calm and togetherness and support might actually go a long way. I mean, the Miguel Angel Ramirez era was just fraught. Christian Latanzio's wasn't all like sunshine and puppy dogs either. Am I mistaken, Doyle? I remember a number of times last year where Latanzio threw his players under the bus.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far. I will just say that it was clear that Latanzio and the front office had different visions for how the game should be played and what the team would be. And Dean Smith, I think, you're right, player development has to be a big part of it. I think talent ID has to be a big part of it. But really, if he can be the guy who has a coherent sporting vision for what this team is, and then as the manager, translate that to the field, then it will be literally a new era and the first coherent era in Charlotte FC's brief history. They just haven't had that. And so I think that kind of came through in how disjointed last year was and how weird some of the decisions that Latanzio made were. And I don't think that needs to be the case this year. And frankly, from what we know of Dean Smith and what we've seen of his teams and what he said in his press conferences, I don't think it will be. I think it'll be, there won't be an inverted left back coming inside to possession in, a 3-2-2-3 for a team that plays on turf and wants to run and has the athletes to do so. I just, like, it's going to be a lot simpler than what we've seen. And for most teams, simpler is good.
Simpler could help alleviate some of the big time issues, one of which turnovers in midfield that led to man down moments for the back line. Just a lot of 1v1 defending for young center backs. And then the late game hiccups. A lot of points left on the table because of errors individually and collectively late in games for Charlotte. The Orange Goats hit us up and says, does Charlotte actually have a chance at landing Gronbeck? And if so, what do you think it would take to make it happen? That's Albert Gronbeck. His name, last name, has the O with the slash through it, as well as the A and the E that are combined, and that feels like a cruel joke, Doyle. Anders said that the O is like a, what was it, like a, Gruenbeck?
Gruenbeck?
So we'll work on that. We'll get some native speakers involved. Bodo Glimt is his current club. That is in the far reaches, nearly to the Arctic Circle in Norway. One of the best clubs in that league. $9.5 million bid for the 22-year-old. He's a 10 that can play on the wing, that both is a goal scorer as well as a chance creator, Doyle. But I think it seems like the goal scorer part is what Charlotte really like, and a pretty clear fit for that number 10 spot in a 4-2-3-1 with Dean Smith.
Yeah, it makes sense, especially if they're going to move on from Karol Swiderski. The hesitancy of it is over the past 7-8 years now, guys who come directly from Norway or Sweden have really struggled at MLS. It's not as much the case, obviously, guys coming from the big teams in Denmark. I mean, Hani Mukhtar being one of them. But the guys who've come directly from Norway or Sweden have not been as good by and large. So it's a lot of money to risk on a player who has only showed it really in a league that is much slower and less physical than what we have here. That said, the guy's in the Danish national team picture. His underlying numbers are fantastic. He is a 10 who is more in the Daniel Gazdag role or mold than in, say, a Bebelo Reynoso or a Carlos Hill role, right? He's not going to get on the ball and orchestrate the game. He is going to get on the ball and go direct and attack. And I think that blends really well with the English version of the game, which is, of course, what Dean Smith is going to bring to the Carolinas. It'll be fascinating. I like the ambition. And worth noting, he is 22 years old, so he would be a young DP. And that would give them a lot of roster flexibility in terms of what he hits the cap at and using all three of the U22 initiative slots.
Over under. Eastern Conference standings 2024, Charlotte FC 6.5.
You're killing me. Come on, it's so early in the season, Weeby. I absolutely refuse to start doing over-unders yet. Half these rosters aren't even done.
Wow, soft.
Well, over-under 6.5. All right, wait. They're not going to be better than Cincinnati. They're not going to be better than Orlando. They're not going to be better than Columbus. They're not going to be better than Philadelphia. I don't think they're going to be better than Atlanta. We're already at 5.
Yeah, that's why I said 6-9 or 7-9. Look at that. I suckered you right into that.
Not going to be better than Miami. So now we're at 6.
Yeah, 7-9.
Okay.
I said a good over-under. Maybe it's more like 7.5 would have been a good one. Either way.
I'll still take the under, but I think just in terms of long-term vision, I think this year is the first year where there can be some actual clarity from Charlotte FC. So even if they end up on 40, 42 points, just like last year, I think it'll be a better year for this franchise as a whole.
Yeah, to me, it's about culture, which has been clearly lacking in the, let's say, the longevity of leadership and of players. And then it's about getting the best out of those top-end spots. Is Karol Swiderski the guy you stick with? If not, is your scouting up to snuff? Can you go get the players that you want? We'll see about this Gronbeck signing as well, because it seems like he has interest from around Europe. That would take a DP spot, and there are a lot of DP spots open. Just to give you an idea before we get out of here today, so you're watching the right things. LA Galaxy have 2. Ricky Puig is the only one. They continue to have some offers rejected, but it looks like Gabriel Peck from Vasco da Gama might be on the way. We'll have a deep dive with Sasha Kleshchen on that one coming up later this week. LAFC, 2 DP spots open. Timbers, RSL, and Montreal also sitting with 2 DP spots open per my numbers. Then the Fire, the Crew, DC United, Houston Dynamo, Minnesota United, Orlando City, San Jose, Seattle, Sporting Kansas City, St. Louis, and Vancouver all have a spot open as well. So those are destinations to watch for marquee signings as this offseason rolls along. Still no news officially on Pedro de la Vega for the Sounders, but the Galaxy look to be in for a right back from Japan as well. And I'm going to roll the dice here. Anders, I know you want us to get out of here. KC Soccer Journal, what should Sporting Kansas City do with their open designated player spot now that Gandhi Kinda is officially gone?
Essential midfielder. I like KC's central midfield. We saw what they did to St. Louis in the playoffs last year. Gandhi Kinda was a big part of that. I like Eric Tomy a lot. Is Eric Tomy the starting number 10 on an MLS Cup caliber team? I'm not sure he is. He could play some minutes for sure, and Remy Voltaire is a good little player. But those two guys up against what we saw from Columbus last year, or up against what we saw Houston do to them, it's just not going to be quite enough talent on the field. So I think that this, you know, this Sporting KC team is calling out for an elite DP number 10.
Transfer window just opened. It's just getting going. A lot more news to come. And let's see, in about a week or so, training camps open. And in about a month, the Vancouver Whitecaps host Tigres at a field seating 6,000 people in British Columbia. It'll be sick. More to come next, let's see, Wednesday or Thursday. We'll make an executive decision on that and let you know on Twitter. In the meantime, enjoy your week. Enjoy this early part of January. The games are coming in just about a month, everybody. We'll see you in a few days. Adios.